From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Conservative essayist and author David Brooks embraces America, its greatness, its quirkiness, its unique dreams. In his columns for the New York Times, his best-selling book Bobos in Paradise, and its new sequel On Paradise Drive, Brooks writes about a country of utopian possibility, a democracy built on dreams of great things just around the corner. Tonight on Point, David Brooks on American politics, America's war in Iraq, and Americans' love affair with the future. But first, the clock ticks for Paul Johnson, the American taken hostage last Saturday in Saudi Arabia. His captors call themselves Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and have given the Saudi government until tomorrow to release Al-Qaeda prisoners or see Johnson killed. Today, Saudi officials combed several neighborhoods in Riyadh in search of the Lockheed Martin engineer. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell said the U.S. is doing everything it can to help the Saudi investigation. Raida Gantu is a correspondent with Reuters in the Saudi capital of Riyadh. I asked her for the latest news on Mr. Johnson's fate.
So far, there are no details about what part of the country he's in. He was kidnapped in Riyadh last Saturday, and the group that has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping calls itself the Al-Qaeda organization in the Arabian Peninsula.
And is this part of a broader campaign to terrorize Westerners in Saudi Arabia? And is it working? Are they leaving?
Well, Al-Qaeda has vowed that 2004 would be, what it said, bloody for the kingdom. And they've also vowed to expel foreigners from the kingdom. And foreigners are worried about the security situation. Many are waiting for the deadline to see if this group is going to go ahead with its threats.
So a number of killings just in the last week and, of course, over the last month, many more. What kind of security response has been visible or public on behalf of the Saudi authorities? Is it clear that there's a large-scale effort underway to find Mr. Johnson?
Well, Crown Prince Abdullah on Tuesday said that the kingdom would be deploying more forces and it would strike back soon against militants, but he hasn't referred to the kidnapping in itself. And security measures have been boosted at residential compounds, at some firms, and around areas where Westerners gather.
Paul Johnson's son in New Jersey has made a plea for his father's safe return. I'm curious, Raida Gantu, if that is even heard in Saudi Arabia. Did the newspapers there pick it up? Is it on the radio?
Well, I'm not sure about the radio. The papers have been covering the security measures and they've been covering the kidnapping case. But so far, the officials in Riyadh have not commented on how they would deal with this. But the Saudi government foreign advisor in Washington, Adel Joubert, has said that Saudi Arabia was consulting with the United States on what actions to take, but that historically the kingdom did not negotiate with militants.
Meanwhile, on some militant Islamist websites, there's been an appeal made on behalf of Paul Johnson by someone identifying himself as Saad the Believer, saying that he wanted to draw a Muslim veil of protection around his friend and colleague, Paul Johnson, that he would never forgive the captors if they killed Paul Johnson. He would curse them in their prayers. Is this being taken seriously? Is this a kind of soap opera at this point?
Well, I myself have not seen that posting on the Internet, but several clerics have recently denounced the attacks that have been taking place and saying that Islam was innocent of such actions.
In other words, these could not be condoned by Islam.
Yes.
Do you get the sense in Saudi Arabia of a high security alert after these attacks in several cities over the last weeks and months, Raida Gantu? Does it have the sense of a country in lockdown or still life as usual?
No, life is still as usual. There's no sense of a lockdown, but Saudi Arabia has been battling militants for a year now, and security measures have been boosted.
And what about the impact on oil production there? Does it matter if Western and foreign residents of Saudi Arabia are fearing for their lives? Are they leaving, and does it cut into Saudi oil production, Saudi economic activity?
Well, some foreigners have rebased their families, especially with summer holidays approaching. Others have decided to leave, and some others are staying. But Saudi officials say that the departure of Western engineers poses no immediate threat to Saudi Arabia's ability to produce oil, but that some analysts say that the attack serves a warning that, you know, if violence continues, it could eventually disrupt operations, but there should be no immediate threat to oil production.
Meanwhile, the clock ticks on Paul Johnson. What have his captors asked for as the condition of his release?
His captors have given the Saudi government until Friday to release jailed militants, or they would kill him. They didn't specify a number of militants, and they also didn't specify what time the countdown began.
But sometime on Friday, if they stick to that deadline, looks like a bad time for Paul Johnson. Rita Gantu, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Rita Gantu is a correspondent with Reuters. She spoke with me from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Columnist David Brooks won a broad following with his writing in the Weekly Standard for being what some called a rational conservative. It's a cheeky label, and Brooks would know. He's deft at a cheeky brand of humor of his own. Now David Brooks holds forth from the op-ed page of the New York Times, and it hasn't exactly been an easy patch lately. The war he urged in Iraq has not gone according to plan. His new book has taken some lumps from merciless critics, but David Brooks is hanging in there, high profile as ever. The war will work out, he says, and the American dreams he trusts in, America's love affair with the future, will prevail. Tonight on Point, New York Times columnist David Brooks. Do you live in the Brooks world of American yearning for paradise on earth? Is the magic of the vision still working in your heart, on your street, in Iraq? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from the studios of NPR West is David Brooks, columnist for the New York Times and author of the best-selling book Bobos in Paradise, The New Upper Class and How They Got There. His new book is On Paradise Drive, How We Live Now and Always Have in the Future Tense. Good evening and welcome, David Brooks.
Good to be with you.
Wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for joining us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Mr. Brooks.
Hello, Jack.
So, David Brooks, here we are on Paradise Drive. What do you mean Americans live in the future tense?
Well, one saw it hundreds of years ago that as the pioneers moved westward, one of the things you noticed was that they would, or as people noticed, was that they would go past perfectly good farmland because they were convinced there was something even better over the next ridge. And I do think there is a mentality that unites us. And basically, I wrote this book to try to explain certain qualities that stand out about America. We tend to work harder than most other people. The average American works 350 hours a year longer than the average European. That's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. We tend to move three or five times as many, as often as Asian and European societies. We switch jobs twice as often. We divorce more. We eat fast food more. We have an incredible sense of energy. Seymour Martin Lipset, the great sociologist of American exceptionalism, described all these traits that sort of distinguish us from many other societies around the world. And I tried to find how these traits play out in average suburban life. And then I tried to explain what mentality leads us to behave in this way.
And what's the link that you found there between that future orientation and the qualities you're describing, David Brooks?
Well, if you go back historically, I think, you know, the first settlers who came to these shores in the 17th century realized two things about this country, or about this continent, I'm talking about the Europeans, was that, first of all, God's plans could be realized here, that they had some unique opportunity to create the fulfillment of all history. And the second thing they realized was that they could get really rich while doing it. And so there's ever since been a merger of a material and spiritual longing and a sense of imminence, a sense that some opportunity is here. And I think that sense of imminence, that sense of opportunity, which is fired by abundance, reinforced by waves of immigrants, has created a distinctly American mentality. And this mentality binds us, whether we like it or not, in ways that are good or not, but do explain the movement out to the suburbs, do explain our tendency to be wasteful about things, do explain our tendency to invest in dot-coms, do explain all sorts of patterns of actual life from how we raise our kids to how we change jobs, to how we invest our money, to how we pray and create incredibly new denominations and unpredictable spiritual movements. And so I do think we are united as a people by this common mentality, I try to dissect.
And we see it there. When you went out to do the reporting for this book and your observations over the years as you put it together, give us some of the nitty-gritty examples that you find, not pioneers in Conestoga wagons, but circa 2003, 2004, that demonstrate what you're talking about here, David Brooks.
Well, 43 million Americans move every year, and basically they're moving out. They're moving from the Northeast and Midwest down to the South and Southwest, and they're moving from inner cities to suburbs to outer ring suburbs. 90% of the office space built in America in the 1990s was built in the suburbs. And so you've got this tremendous mobility and movement. You've got new suburbs springing up, like Mesa, Arizona, which is a suburb outside of Phoenix. More people live in Mesa than live in St. Louis, Cincinnati, and Minneapolis. Mesa will soon pass Atlanta in population. So you've got this incredible drive outward. And I think that drive is motivated by some of the sense of imminence and some of the fantasy that I've been talking about. But the other thing you've got along with that outward is segmentation. As you drive through suburbia, it is no longer the white bread Ozzie and Harriet place of popular stereotype. You can drive 5 miles and reach incredibly different suburban zones. You can start, you know, where I live or in New England or wherever you are in the country, and I take a little drive in the book, and I start in one of these progressive country, sort of what I call the crunchy suburbs, where there are plenty of, you know, pottery collectives and sandal stores because progressives have a thing for toe exhibitionism. And then I move outward. And you go out to the sort of the high-achieving, high-income suburbs where you have these high-achieving women who take time off so they can get their kids into Harvard. And these women tend to weigh less than their children. And there's sort of an ethos there, which is totally different than you have in the less materialistic, crunchy suburb. Then you go another 5 miles, and you begin to see Pakistani grocery stores, the news boxes for the Korea Central Daily. You begin to see Nigerian worship services, and you're out in an immigrant zone, a totally different culture, a few miles away.
And in all those, the sense of imminence that you describe, David Brooks, is anticipating what? What is it that's just over the horizon, in your view?
Well, each individual has their own sense of imminence. But if you look at one of the ways Americans are different from other people around the world, aside from the mobility, is if you ask Americans this question, do you feel you control your own destiny? Americans overwhelmingly think they do. People in European societies tend to think that, no, there are actually larger social forces that control their destiny. Margaret Mead observed that the United States is the only country or the only culture she had studied in which children are raised to think that they will lead lives unlike their parents. And that, too, is a sense of that there is some different future out there awaiting each individual, and that each individual is sort of on a personal mission to realize that sense of achievement, that destiny for themselves. Now, each of us have radically different definitions of that vision of perfection. All you have to do is walk down the magazine stand and you look at some people read Architectural Digest, which portrays all these perfect homes that no one could possibly live in, little visions of heaven where, you know, it's so neat that people could look like they vacuum out the inside of their toasters. And then you go out to another magazine, Murder Dog or the Rat Magazine, a totally different vision of heaven. Everyone has their own distinct visions, but there is the same sense of energy and mobility.
Jack Beatty, David Brooks is here to tell us we've got it all with us now and just over the horizon, that paradise just around the bend. Are you drawn in? Is this your America, Jack Beatty?
Well, first of all, that jibe about the sandals really hurt. Boy,
I'm tucking my toes under.
Yeah. You know, I think of David Brooks as a pitcher for an opposing team, a really good pitcher with a killer changeup. You know, you expect the fastball, and here comes the changeup, and you break your back swinging at the thing. So I have the greatest respect for him. This is an entertaining book. I recommend everybody read it. On the other hand, I do feel reading this that it's David Brooks meet George Babbitt. Here I am at the banquet, you know, I'm looking out over the folks in Mesa here, and I'm saying, you know, in the 19th century, the people came here, they were lit, they were aglow with the future, and they reached out and they created America, and they lived in the future tense. There was slavery, I won't put it in the book. Oh, there was violence, we won't follow it. Well, don't worry about that. this is going to work out great. Today, you may think I'm just collecting, Tommy Bahama shirts. I'm looking for transcendence. I've got it going right here. Don't you mock me, you sandal wearer. I'm on to something big. I got the paradise.
Hang on to
spell.
It, Jack. I hear it coming up over the horizon here. We're talking with David Brooks, New York Times columnist. His new book is on Paradise Drive. You can join the conversation. Is this your paradise? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New York Times columnist David Brooks. His new book is On Paradise Drive, How We Live Now and Always Have in the Future Tense. You can join our conversation tonight. Is belief in a golden future still the American creed, or has the advance celebration become an evasion of what's going on right now? Are we living under the spell of a future paradise just around the corner? If you are, what does it mean for your politics? If you're not, what's the alternative vision that lines up with America's vast possibilities? We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David Brooks, I wonder how it feels. You've had such a golden career and just sort of knocked it out of the park in every position you've been in. Everybody loved Bobos in Paradise. But this time, there is a kind of pushback, and you must feel it very keenly. You're a close reader. People are giving you some trouble about this book. They're doubting your interpretation of the facts. They're giving you a hard time on the way you handle the American reality. They're saying, you know, he's pitching for a team, but it's we don't know what team it is. It's just not the same friendly reception that you've surely grown accustomed to because you've had it and deserved it. How do you interpret that?
Well, you know, it is interesting, and I didn't expect it. Every single reviewer who I know is a liberal has disliked the book, with the exception of Alan Wolfe. Every single reviewer who I know is a conservative has liked the book. Most of the reviewers who have no politics, like Entertainment Weekly, they've tended to like it.
Yeah.
But it has broken down in utterly predictable lines, and I don't mean that there. Some people from the left are attacking me for things I've written in the column. I should mention that George Bush does not appear in the book. There's no politics in the book. Some of them are not in the mood to be amused by me, since I supported the war, I think. Some of them sincerely find this book much inferior to my previous book. And conservatives tend to think it's about as good as the previous book, at least in the review level. So there has been a complete polarization in the reaction, at least among the reviewers. As I've traveled around the country, they've sent me so far to places like Berkeley, Santa Monica, Philadelphia, and the Upper West Side of New York.
Tough territory.
So I actually haven't seen a conservative in about a month. But from more liberal readers, the reception has been nicer than among the reviewers. But I will say that the polarization of the country has been reflected certainly in the reviews, which I certainly didn't expect, because the book is not too political. It is about the suburbs. And I should say it's not a celebration of the suburbs at all. It's a very ambivalent, though ultimately positive, look at what's happening in the suburbs. But some of the satire is quite biting. The suburbs are a controversial flashpoint in American culture.
Well, but something has changed in the weather here. I mean, you've had a pretty good reception from liberal reviewers in the past. There was a lot they could cotton to in the way you expressed your view, even if they didn't like the bottom line. Do you take it back to the Iraq War, or Bobos in Paradise is not so many years ago. Has the country really changed so much in those handful of years, or have you somehow changed, David Brooks, in the way you see the world, the way you communicate it, describe it?
Yeah, I really don't think I've changed that much. I think this book is about a different demographic than the Bobos a little, though I think the book is roughly similar. I really do. I've read it again, and I really think it's similar. I think a couple things have changed. A, my profile has changed. I'm now at the New York Times, and somebody said to me when I joined the Times, welcome to the New York Times, where it's all criticism all the time. Somebody else, Aaron Brown, said to me, I was on his show, you know, when you play in the big leagues, people are going to throw balls at your head. So I'm now taking moral philosophy from a cable talk show host. That's great.
Welcome to the roller derby. Jack Beatty, let me ask you. David Brooks says there's no politics in this book. And there's not politics in the sense that there are no political essays. But at another level, this book is absolutely fundamental to some kind of meta-dialogue in American politics, it seems to me. What do you think?
Yeah, I do think that. In The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, there's a wonderful moment where a newspaper editor is asked to write about an outlaw, and they said, here's the truth about him. And he looks at the copy. He says, oh, no, sir, this is the West. When the facts interfere with the legend, print the legend. And this is print the legend stuff. It's print the legend about American history. I don't recognize American history in this. It's print the legend about today, this searching for my transcendence in my Tommy Bahama shirt. Heck, you know, all of the low-wage work, the uninsured, all the jobs going abroad. None of that enters into it. And the future, by gosh, it's going to be an American. It's going to be an American pool. We're all going to be in there together, and it's going to be terrific. I mean, I don't know anybody who doesn't look at our future today with unmitigated dread. Or varieties of dread. But this kind of, so yes, this sort of celebration of the past and of America is part of the culture of complacency. It's part of the essence of what it means to be a conservative in America. You're complacent about the way the society is. It's basically pretty good because the government is more or less out of it and people are striving and they're doing their thing. Yeah, there are imperfections. But, you know, you read this and you think, hey, I'm an American. Things are great. Well, gee whiz, that's not the America that I see all around me.
David Brooks, how about it? Is Jack Beatty just missing America the Beautiful, or are you printing the legend? Or are you buying into a culture of complacency?
I half agree. First of all, you know, one of the models I take in the book, and I talk about this at the end, is Walt Whitman's great essay, Democratic Vistas. And that essay, one of the things I really admire about that essay is, first of all, there'll be one paragraph on how crass and vulgar American culture is. And then the next paragraph, he'll talk about how inspiring it is to walk down the street and see different sorts of people. Then in the next paragraph, he'll talk about how awful all the novels are. And then the next paragraph, he'll talk about how heroic the Civil War soldiers are. And it's sort of incoherent. But he never tries to reconcile these two different sides of America. And I think that's in my book. Many people see this as sort of a bitter attack on the suburbs. I've gotten some of that as well, because there are attacks on some of the fast-growing, sprawling exurbs and sort of the culture of golf that surrounds there, the sort of calm corporate types where everybody, you know, makes Dick Cheney look bipolar. So there is that kind of satire in there. Nonetheless, I think one of the things I agree with Jack, and one of the things I would never say, where Jack said everybody he knows looks at the future with various degrees of dread, that's something I don't feel. And that's something where I do come from a different place from Jack, where I tend to be I drive around the country and I interview. I went to 36 states for this book, talked to thousands of people, and came away just incredibly optimistic about the country. So I think there really is a sensibility difference here. And I think in some sense, I really don't think it's complacency, but I do think my sensibility rubbed a lot of people the wrong way who don't share that sensibility.
Jack Beatty, are you and David Brooks just drawing from different wells here? I mean, are you so sure that Americans live in utter dread of the future? Even if that's true in some respects, people can maybe just be bipolar enough to also have deep wells of optimism, don't you think, Jack?
Oh, I think so. And I don't say the Americans. I'm just saying friends of mine. And I don't get out. I just walk to the Dartmouth Library every day. I mean, that's the America I see. So I'm no expert on any of this. And this is a matter of temperament, to be sure. But my friends, people who talk to me, I mean, what do they share in common? They're serious people. They read. They take the country seriously. And they are terribly afraid. They're worried about their children's economic future in a world where you know, unless you do a face-to-face job, somebody in a foreign country is going to beat you out of any kind of the work you have. A world where we're going to have terrorism, you know, I mean, I feel like George Bush has loaded a pistol and put it to my son's head. I mean, and this is going to go on and on and on. So my friends, at least, just are near despair at the sense of things in America and at the distance we are from dealing with our real problems. And one of the things that puts us away from that is the celebration, is the greatness of America. That sort of Jim Lehrer, Jim, it's a great country, isn't it? Yeah, if you're making a lot of dough. But for many people...
David Brooks, here we go. Here's the bridge to politics. You've written just recently about Ronald Reagan's optimism. George Bush, who says, look, Iraq is in trouble, but we're never going to let it down. Everything's going to work out here. How do you pull these together, or do these twain meet, David Brooks?
First, I'm still sucking on the gas pipe. Jack has depressed me so much. No, listen, if you're going to change things, you've got to do it out of a sense of optimism. That's one of the things I think this future orientation does, is it gives people the energy and the mobility and almost the desperate sense that they have to move forward in ways that are sometimes incredibly unhealthy. But there has always been, along with this future optimism, and I describe it fully in the book, this incredible sense of anxiety, this sense that we've been assigned this unique mission, that we are not living up to it. And that anxiety, some historians say, is what really what sort of forged this character I'm talking about. So the idea that this optimism is a sunny optimism without a dark side is just a ridiculous notion, and not a notion I talk about in the book. There has always been a sense, and T.S. Eliot wrote made the nice observation that Americans dream of being liberated from the future, of not always having to strive, of not having this desperate sense, as even John Winthrop put it in Reagan's favorite quotation.
City on the Hill.
And after he talked about the city on hill, the next sentiment was that if we fail in this mission, we will become a byword for people around the world as having uniquely failed and disastrously failed and letting God down. And there was always that anxiety.
But as I describe
in the book, anxiety is the propulsion that leads to all the mobility. And it grows not out of desperation, not out of pessimism. It grows out of a sort of hopefulness, a problematic hopefulness.
But let me ask you something. Leave aside that dark side for a moment. Is it possible to exploit that Native American optimism that you describe, sort of paper over problems that might need addressing? It seems to be what Jack's suggesting. By talking about great country, we will prevail. See the deficit, never mind. We're great, we will prevail. Is it possible, is it happening, that Native American optimism can be exploited?
Yeah, I really don't think so. I think people are both optimistic and troubled. Nobody being optimistic and being basically generally loving the way people live every day, which I do, it doesn't mean that you're just sitting around saying, oh, things are just great, let's sit back and sip our cappuccinos. It's just not the sentiment. When one of my ideas that led to this book was when I was living in Europe. And there it is a more pessimistic culture, but it's also a culture with a lot less energy and a lot less mobility. Mm-hmm. When I was living in Brussels for 4.5 years, there's a city an hour and a half away called Liège. Liège had a 25% unemployment rate. Brussels had under a 5% unemployment rate. Same language, hour and a half away. Why didn't the people from Liège go to seek jobs in Brussels? That would have happened in the United States.
Sure would.
And it didn't happen there. And it was a sense of fatalism, a sense that you were going to... Liège was your place, and you were not going to move. And so I think, to the contrary, that it is the sense of possibility, the sense of grapes just out of reach that lead us to solve our problems, do not lead us away from the problem.
Let's listen to our listeners. A lot of them would like to join the conversation. Dan's calling from Hartsdale, New York. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. I think what Mr. Brooks is peddling is what they used to call the opiate of the masses. I'm sure his book will do well because the people who he writes for do want to feel good, and many of them do because they're making the money. And I think the reason why your other guests' friends aren't feeling so good is because they're probably not buying the stuff that Mr. Brooks and our government is selling about how terrific everything is, and we think we're living in the post-World War II generation.
But Dan, let me ask you, don't you see a kind of Native optimism in the American character? Do you dispute that?
Native means you're born with it. I don't see us as being any different than anybody else. We just have had in the past different experiences, and we expect to have that in the future. The way things are going right at this point, though, they don't look so wonderful to me now, both in view of with respect to whatever, the environment, our natural resources, a whole bunch of stuff that's happening, including the diminution of our freedoms and the merger of government and business, such that I don't think you're going to see the kind of mobility that you see. We have a stratification of the society here with poor people or middle-class people getting poorer and the super-rich getting rich. It's kind of probably getting more like Europe now.
So you're just not buying the schema that David Brooks lays out. David Brooks, let me ask you, to Dan's point, he says it's not native optimism. That means, we're born with it. It's circumstantial. We inherited a great continent with all its resources and the opportunity that meant. If the circumstances change, in your analysis, does the character stay the same? If the circumstances are not quite as, if the gravy's not quite as deep anymore, does the optimism remain?
Well, culture is a very stubborn thing. Alexis de Tocqueville came here in 1830 around, and a lot of things he described about this country still fit, even though many of us had no ancestors there at the time. Orwell wrote a great essay on nationalism, when how nationalism affects a personality. And he asks, what do I have in common with an Englishman of 500 years ago? And he answers, it's the same thing I have in common with a photo of myself as a five-year-old. A lot is different, but it is me. And I do think national culture does last a long time. Nonetheless, we're not born with it. We're inculcated with a national culture, sometimes unselfconsciously. But I would just say, to Dan's point about how terrible things are, you know, there's a pessimism that is just as unrealistic as optimism can be. They're both moods, and both can be wrong. You know, just starting with the environment, there's this sense that the environment is getting worse. That's just not true. Air is a third cleaner. The water is cleaner. I think there's a third more forests on the East Coast than there were 200 years ago. We've made tremendous strides in environmental progress over the past 20 years, 30 years. And to say that things aren't getting better, at least in that respect, is just not true.
So chit up, but keep thinking. Kristen is calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Hi, Kristen. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks, Kristen.
I am a 30-year-old Bobo. And
bourgeois bohemian. Okay.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, the Bobo's in Paradise, I read it when it came out, and really it could have been written about me and my friends. It's kind of hilarious, except that sadly, because I've been in medical school and in residency, I haven't yet ascended to the truly moneyed part of that, which, you know, would be nice if I was. But
more,
anyway.
More bohemian than bourgeois.
No,
still.
No okay. Sub-Zero yeah, yet? No, no Corian counters?
Right. So, yeah, it's a little sad. But anyway, I'm really looking forward to reading this new book because although I am extremely liberal in terms of my politics, I'm also really an optimist, and I really like what you're saying about thinking that, you know, there's a real value in sort of looking at the positive and looking at the energy that we have in this country to do good, and I mean, that's sort of what turns things to the way we want them in the first place. Now, I have one idea that I wondered what you thought about it.
Let's
I've
have
always
it.
Sort of thought about this country as being kind of like an adolescent nation. In a lot of the ways you're describing, we're extremely idealistic. We feel passionately about our values. We want to go and shout them to everybody and make everybody else sort of be the way we are because it's so great. And we do that with great fervor. But also, I think, sometimes we lack the follow-through. Sometimes we lack the temperance of those ideas. In other words, like we think that democracy is great, so we want to sort of go and get everybody to do that. Regardless, and we want to do it quickly, and we want to do it as strongly as we can without sort of tempering that with perhaps the wisdom of maturity.
Kristen, we've got it in the context, too. A break's coming up. Let me put it straight to David Brooks. I think we can hear the subtext there, and thanks for your call, David Brooks. How about it? The idealism is there, says Kristen, but what about the follow-through, the feet on the ground maybe in Iraq?
Yeah, well, my line about Iraq is that only a country as idealistic enough as us would have tried to democratize Iraq. Only a country as naive as us would have done so badly at it. So I do essentially agree with that. Even in domestic culture, nothing ever stops at its logical conclusion. We go to excess in sort of an adolescent, exuberant way about everything. You look at the Price Club stores, which are like Walmart on acid with these huge quantities of everything. The materialism gets carried away, the dreams get carried away. There is sort of this exuberance, which is essentially an immature quality.
David Brooks, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight with New York Times columnist David Brooks. His new book is On Paradise Drive, How We Live Now and Always Have in the Future Tense. When we trim the lawn and buy new deck chairs, are we building heaven on earth one piece at a time in the United States? And what kind of conservative is David Brooks? What niche do you put him in? Does his picture of America ring true to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined tonight by New York Times columnist David Brooks. His new book is On Paradise Drive. You can join us as well. Does David Brooks' picture of America ring true to you, to your life, to your America? What about his picture of Iraq on the other side of crisis? Do you share David Brooks' confidence that we're on a down and dirty path to glory, or at least something better? And there's this. Brooks sees Republicans as now the party of hope and Democrats as the party of resignation. Do you agree? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jesse's calling from Ringwood, New Jersey. Hi, Jesse. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm 23. I graduated a year ago with a degree in engineering, and I haven't been able to find a job. And I look at the lack of industry, the Social Security, Medicare benefits, that I'm going to have to be paying for in 15, 20 years, maybe up to 50% of my taxes, my income, is going to go to that. And I look at it and go, how can I ever live up to what my parents provided me with? And to sort of look at this and the different field of Iraq, I think it's going to be hard, and I think it can be done in a good way. And I think regardless of what's going to happen, the people are better off with a new regime as opposed to Saddam.
But in your case, at home, you're wondering how you grab hold of that brass ring, that American dream.
Yeah.
David Brooks, what do you say to Jesse? He's 23. He's got his degree. He doesn't have a job. He's not sure he's going to live as well as his parents. Does he fit your profile?
Well, there are a couple things to be said. The first about the Social Security and the Medicare, there you've got a real worry. These are two programs that are, especially Medicare, which are going to be facing real problems over the next 20 years as the boomers retire. There's no sign of a solution coming out of Washington, so that's a worry. I can't talk to individual cases, but I can tell you in general that people with educated degrees tend to do reasonably well. Education is now rewarded with money these days, so if you have an engineering degree, the odds are extremely good that your income over when the economy picks up will be a lot higher than somebody with a high school degree or with no degree. Incomes on average in this country have been rising pretty steadily over the past 40 or 50 years. If you look at this chart, you almost can't tell who's president. There's just the economy sort of churns along. Now, I don't want to sound like I'm Pangloss. There's widening inequality. There are pockets of poverty, not more than pockets. There's widespread poverty. 46% of those who live in poverty live in the suburbs, no longer in inner city neighborhoods. So there are problems, and there always will be problems. But that doesn't mean we should assume that the country is in decline. You know, if you look over American social science, what you find is this unremitting parade of pessimism. You go back to the social science of the 50s, of the 30s, of the 20s, of 1740, when America became, or at least the American colonies became, the richest citizens on earth. In all those times, there has been this parade that doom was always just around the corner. And you look at those books predicting running out of oil, predicting running out of food, and they share one thing in common. Some of them, many brilliant books, but they have tended to be wrong because decadence hasn't come. The country has not collapsed. We haven't slipped, as Robert Bork said, into Gomorrah. We haven't slipped into cultural relativism, as Alan Bloom said. The country seems to be able to hang in there. And the optimists have, in general, been more justified by the facts than the pessimists.
So, Jesse, chin up. David Brooks says, don't bet against the system. Gabe's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Gabe, you're on the air.
Hi. While we're talking about the Americans, I thought I might bring up the other 5,700,000+ people in the world.
Oh, them, yes.
And ask what Mr. Brooks would have to say to the people in Sudan and Congo and rural Peru and various other spots around the world about how they should interpret the American approach to life and where do they fit in. Is the idea that another five generations in the sweatshops and then they too can have a tract home in a irrigated desert just like the American Bobos can have, or is there anything more hopeful for them?
You're not resonating with David Brooks' kind of satiric celebration or view of consumerism, Gabe.
I think if you take a global perspective, it's a pretty tin horn deal. Looks like the only people we can help out right now are the Iraqis, and after that we've shot our load. Everybody else is on their own.
David Brooks, what do you say?
First, I think a lot of the people in Sudan would be happy with a tract home in Mesa, Arizona right now. I'm just refusing to be categorized as Mr. Pangloss. The idea that I've sort of denying problems in the world, I make my living talking about problems in the world. What I'm saying is nothing less than what Martin Luther King said with the I Have a Dream speech. When Martin Luther King said, I have a dream, and talked about the American dream and how it applied to the black experience, was he saying blacks have no problems? On the contrary. But he was saying there are answers to the problems. He was being optimistic about the future, and it was that optimism that mobilized the civil rights movement. Now, I don't have to say that things in Sudan are wonderful. I don't have to say that things in the Congo are wonderful. We've all seen the statistics of how many people have been killed in those places over the past months and years. So the idea that I'm Mr. Pangloss, who says we don't have to do anything, is just ridiculous. When you look at the world, you see some pockets where there has been progress, and it's just not right to deny that. There were 10 democracies in the world in 1900. There are now, depending on how you count it, 80 or 120 or 170. None of those democracies are perfect. We have Florida, but they are all better than they were before. When you look at living standards in places like India and China, they're improving. And yes, maybe some of them are buying sub-zero refrigerators and living in tract homes, but it's a lot better than the hovels they were living in. And so the materialism, the striving to have a nicer home, a nicer range, I don't laugh at that materialism, in part because I think it's a rare individual for whom that materialism is enough. I think most people, whether they live in a tract home or do not, want to have what we all want to have. They want to have a spiritual sense of peace. Most of them want to have a relationship with God so they can feel connected to something sacred and holy. And to pretend that they don't want these things, that they have no spiritual bone in their body, comes close to snobbery.
David Brooks, there's so much we're not going to get to tonight. I want to be sure we don't miss a chance to talk for a minute about Iraq. And particularly, I want to ask you about this, as a reader of your columns, what looked like a big wobble for David Brooks between April 17th and May 18th. April 17th, of course, things were looking bad in Iraq, and it was the day that you published your column saying, I never thought it would be this bad. And you sounded pretty shaken by the way things were going. A month later, you found your feet, and you described it as, you know, this is what Americans do. They dive in over their heads, then they find their feet, and they march ahead. They never do realize the utopia they initially dreamed about Europe, but they do build something better than what came before. What happened to you that led to the April 17th column that brought you back on May 18th? Did your conservative buddies gather around, lay hands on you, and get you back on board, or did circumstances in Iraq just change? How do you see it now?
No, they're more angry at me now than they were then, my conservative buddies. Listen, what happened in Iraq, I don't think I've lost that sense of disillusion. Anybody who supported this war as I did, even in a scribbling form, has lost a lot of sleep over what's happened because things have not gone as I thought. I knew they would be bad. I wrote for Jack Beatty's magazine before it all started, predicting how damaged Iraq would be and how bad it would be. But nonetheless, I didn't think it would be as bad as it was. I didn't think we'd be fighting battles for cities this late into the occupation. And I didn't think how badly we would manage just on a competence level. Nonetheless, I think what's happened over the past month has restored some of my sense of possibility. And that's that we've recovered from our fundamental error, which is that we hoarded sovereignty. We hoarded power. This whole idea of nation building, of gift wrapping a nation, and then handing it back to the citizens of that nation is anti-democratic. But finally, in the last few weeks, we've handed real power over to Iraqis and over to this interim government. So they're not sitting around waiting for Paul Bremer to make a decision. They're actually making decisions for themselves. And I wrote one column somewhere in that mix saying, for us to win in Iraq, we have to lose. We have to give them elections so they can vote against us, campaign against us, and campaign for themselves, and sort of establish their future with ballots and ideas rather than with rockets and RPGs. And that's what I still fundamentally cling to. Did I have that awareness? Could I have written that column when the war started? No, I didn't know enough. Have I lost faith now? No. I think the Iraqi people can build their country.
There's David Brooks still delivering. David Brooks, your sport to be with us and to be on the road. Thanks for being with us tonight. Thanks for the new book.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
David Brooks, author of On Paradise Drive. Jack Beatty, last word goes to you, my friend.
Put me down as a pessimist of the intellect, optimist of the will.
An optimist of the will. Hey, long may it wave. Jack, thanks for being with us. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a lesson for 21st century women from the Stepford Wives. This is On Point. The Stepford Wives, the remake of the 1975 sci-fi comedy thriller about men who turned their wives into creepily perfect Martha Stewart robots, debuted at a surprisingly strong fourth place in its first weekend at the box office, raking in $22 million. The film stars Nicole Kidman as a deposed television network exec who is transplanted to a picturesque Connecticut town full of reprogrammed wives.
Good morning, ladies.
Good morning, Claire.
I would like you all to welcome our newest citizen to Stepford, Joanna.
Good morning, Joanna.
Are we ready to work out?
Oh, yes.
Although the original story was written 30 years ago, Maryland resident Susan Reimer says it still speaks to women in 2004. In this radio diary, Susan Reimer shares the lessons the Stepford Wives offers 21st century women struggling to balance career and family.
In 1972, Ira Levin, riding the crest of the wave generated by Rosemary's Baby, wrote a book about an idyllic Connecticut community named Stepford, where insecure men retooled their restless wives into robotic beauties who did nothing but cook, clean, and praise them in bed. The 1975 movie version of The Stepford Wives drew the ire of feminists everywhere, who criticized it not as anti-feminist, but as a cynical commercial ripoff of the movement. Betty Friedan stormed out of a screening near tears. Screenwriter Eleanor Perry told the New York Times that she didn't know what all the fuss was about because most men she knew did want big breasts, big bottoms, a clean house, fresh perk coffee, and sex. I rented a copy of the original Stepford Wives, starring a vacant Catherine Ross as the doomed Joanna, and aside from the bell-bottom pants and the unfortunate window treatments, it didn't seem all that out of date to me. Ross plays a vaguely depressed and generally unfulfilled woman who frustrates her husband to the breaking point because she can't articulate the unhappiness she expects him to relieve. I caught myself thinking that the only difference was that he did something about it, while men today take their wives' disaffection in their burdened stride with a sigh of resignation. I then rushed out to the movie theater to see the remake starring Nicole Kidman as Joanna, who triumphs in the end thanks to a plot twist that might finally cause Betty Friedan to dry her tears. In the new Stepford, men are not using technology to quell growing independence in their wives. Rather, the women were all corporate and legal lionesses before their mysterious transformation into strangely serene Martha Stewarts. It isn't clear what prompts the men to reprogram their wives until Nicole's milquetoast husband, Walter, played by Matthew Broderick, asks in exasperation what will make her happy, and she says that she doesn't know. That would do it in my house. If there's a kernel of truth in both movies, it is revealed in eerily similar scenes. Both Catherine Ross and Nicole Kidman, overwhelmed by the cheerful domesticity surrounding them, wonder aloud if perhaps this isn't how life is supposed to be lived. For a moment, both Joannas wonder if they'd be better off if they were happy, creating a tranquil and comfortable home for their husband and children. Strangely, that question is as much on the tongues of women today as it was 30 years ago. What has ambition brought us? Does having it all mean having all the pathologies too? Wife or working woman, pick one and be happy with your choice. It is a measure of how far the feminist movement has brought women and the opportunities open to them that we have such a choice to make. But it is also a measure of how ambivalent we continue to be that we are trying to work out the answer in our art, or what passes for art. I am waiting for someone to remake Diary of a Mad Housewife. Like Joanna, women today struggle with a waking dream full of incongruities that they can't seem to explain to their husbands or their shrinks or to anybody else. It makes you wish somebody could just change the chip in your brain.
Susan Reimer is a columnist with the Baltimore Sun. She lives in Annapolis, Maryland, with her husband and two children. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth and Cora Peterson. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.